From WVUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Incoming chief economist at the International Monetary Fund, Raghuram Rajan, believes in free markets. And he believes free markets are in trouble. Scandal, anti-globalization sentiment, and layoffs have soured public attitudes, and too many big businesses are ready to ride that anger to roll back free market reform. Tonight on Point, incoming IMF chief economist Raghuram Rajan on globalization and its discontents. Again in Washington, where Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan today gave his twice-yearly testimony to Congress addressing interest rates, the deficit, and the threat of deflation. I asked Wall Street Journal reporter Greg Yip what Greenspan said about the economy.
Greenspan gave what I would call a restrained, cautiously optimistic outlook on the economy. He cited several reasons why we should have a strong recovery at the later part of this year. First of all, we've had very low mortgage rates for some time now, which has enabled households to restructure their balance sheets, lower their borrowing costs, and in some cases borrow against the value of their homes, which gives them money to spend. And we've had corporations have been able to refinance a lot of their debts at lower interest rates and basically set the stage for an upturn in profits and, we hope, investment. But he also had to acknowledge that really there's very little evidence that this long hope for recovery has yet begun. He basically said the data on things like employment and production are mixed. And he also admitted that there's a lot of downside risks to the economy. For example, oil is back above $30 a barrel, natural gas prices remain stubbornly high, and overseas economies look like they're slowing down quite a bit.
Deflation was still flitting around in the edges of Greenspan's remarks as well.
Greenspan did mention deflation, but I have to say that he did not dwell on the topic, and I think that there was some attention paid to the fact that he didn't talk about deflation as much as he has in some previous testimonies. And also, when he talked about deflation, he said, well, basically the way to handle it is what we're doing now, which is to hold interest rates down at these very low levels for a long time. You know, there'd been a lot of anticipation that the Fed, given that its short-term interest rate was almost zero, would start doing sort of more novel and unorthodox things to stimulate the economy, like going out and buying large quantities of bonds. And the fact that he did not suggest that anything like that was in the offing was actually a bit of a disappointment today. As a result, we saw bond prices decline and bond yields go up quite a bit. And that, unfortunately, is probably the exact opposite of what Greenspan was hoping to achieve today.
Why might he have avoided signaling steps like that, Greg?
Tom, it's really unclear at this point. We know that the Fed, their staff, the policymakers, Mr. Greenspan himself, have been for months studying what the contingencies are in case their main short-term interest rate eventually goes to zero and they need some other way of helping the economy. And they spent a lot of their June 24th to 25th policy meeting discussing this, but they just haven't come to a consensus yet. Mr. Greenspan told us today that essentially the reason for that is that they feel the economy is going to be picking up and that if they need to give some more juice to the economy, then the way to do that is to cut the federal funds rate some more, perhaps all the way to zero. And so there really is no need at this point to trot out these unconventional policies.
What do his comments on his willingness to keep interest rates low mean for the economy, mean for mortgage rates, mean for consumers and businesses?
Tom, it's really hard to figure out right now. If you'd asked me 2 months ago when the Fed first implied that they were going to keep rates low for a long time, I would have said that's great news. You know, if I'm a bond investor, I'm going to buy up all the long-term bonds I can get because I'm not going to get much better than this in terms of a return for my money. And that would have been great for mortgage rates. And in fact, that's exactly what happened for about a month and a half between May 6th and mid-June before their last policy move. Long-term bond yields came down a lot. They crashed to the lowest level since the 50s. And mortgage rates followed suit. And we saw a huge surge in refinancing volumes. But what's happened since then? Well, the Fed has made that commitment, if anything, even stronger. And the bond market's gone in the opposite direction. So frankly, I don't really know what it means anymore.
Meanwhile, elsewhere in the universe, we have an enormous federal budget deficit.
The White House is talking about well over
$400 billion.
Did you say record red ink?
Record red ink, at least in nominal terms, in the absolute number, if not in percent of the economy.
Yep.
And a trade deficit at record levels as well. Yep. Were there any specific references to those by Greenspan? How do they factor in?
You know, Greenspan has to be a bit conflicted on this whole issue of the tax cut and the deficit. You know, back in February, he was feeling so bullish about the economy, he was telling Congress, hey, look, just wait till the Iraq war is out of the way. I think you'll find that things pick up after that. Don't do this tax cut. Well, we're, what, now 3 months past the end of major hostilities in Iraq, and the economy is still kind of in the dumpster. And Greenspan today was having to admit that, yes, it's a good thing that these tax cuts are coming along. But when he was pushed on the issue by congressmen, he said, over the long term, I'm still really worried about the size of this budget deficit, and that if it's allowed to continue at these levels, it will contribute to upward pressure on interest rates. That will hurt investment and our ability to grow.
So not a real clear view coming out of this day's comments on the economy.
I think what Greenspan really has been trying to do has been to clarify the message of the Fed for the last month or two, which is, we think the economy is going to improve. We think it's going to do quite well. But we also think it's highly unlikely inflation is going to go up. We think it's actually quite possible it will go down. Do not expect us to raise interest rates anytime soon. And they keep trying to pound that message forward. And they've had, frankly, only intermittent success at having it make any difference to the markets.
So far. Greg, thanks for joining us.
All right, Tom.
Greg Ipp covers the economy for the Wall Street Journal. He spoke with us earlier from Washington. Countries turn to the IMF when their economies spiral downward. The countries look for help. The IMF often responds with hard-to-swallow medicine. Raghuram Rajan is stepping in this fall as the IMF's new chief economist and hopes to turn the IMF into a benevolent doctor. But it's still all about free markets, he says. If we're not careful, he argues, corporate titans and short-sighted politicians may derail the decades-long trend toward a free market world. Are freer markets the answer to global economic woe? What are the global lessons of the 90s boom, bust, and scandals? What do you want to tell the new chief economist of the IMF? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Chicago is Raghuram Rajan, the IMF's incoming chief economist and finance professor at the University of Chicago Business School. He is co-author of the new book, Saving Capitalism from the Capitalists. Good evening and welcome, Raghuram Rajan.
Good evening.
Thank you so much for joining us. Also with us tonight from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beattie, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly Magazine. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, and hello to our guest.
Raghuram Rajan, we're delighted to have you. I guess you take over the helm as chief economist in October, is that right?
Yes, I do.
And you set new marks in being both the youngest ever chief economist at the International Monetary Fund at 40, if you'll still be 40 then, and also the first from the third world. You're originally from India, though you've been at Chicago for a long time now. So maybe you carry a special mantle and a special burden coming in that way. There's so much we want to talk about tonight, but I guess I'd just ask you straight out, right off the top of the bat, you're coming into a very big job, a lot of responsibility, the world economy not in the best of shape. In the most parsed down way you can give it to us, what are your major concerns?
About the world economy, in the short run, obviously, the fact that Europe, Japan, and the United States are in some sense in a bad way. So the three big engines are in some sense not sputtering and not working as well as they could. Mm-hmm. But I'm really also concerned about the longer term, which is that we should make sure that the challenges that are coming in front of us, challenges stemming, for example, from the aging of populations, challenges stemming from the increasing globalization, that we meet those challenges without reversing much of the progress that has taken place over the last 30 years.
And that's what we want to dig in with you tonight, Raghuram Rajan. The IMF is famous for dispensing free market ideology and practical advice in recent decades. You're coming into this position as chief economist with a big new book under your arm, as co-author there, of Saving Capitalism from the Capitalists. And in some sense, we read the book as a very comprehensive defense of the same free market system that the IMF has taken an awful lot of brickbats for prescribing around the world. Is this same old, same old? Are you saying, well, if you didn't like free market the first time, you know, try it again? Sit differently as you drink it, or are you describing something new here in your prescription?
Well, here's what we're trying to say. We certainly feel, as anybody coming from Chicago would, that free markets, in some sense, are the best way to bring prosperity to everyone.
And there's a lot of evidence for that.
Well, that's because in many countries around the world, markets aren't really allowed to work. And the reason they aren't allowed to work is in some sense, they need a strong infrastructure to back them. And the infrastructure in many countries is underdeveloped. The question is, why is that infrastructure underdeveloped? And our answer is because it's not allowed to develop in many countries. And this is, in some sense, where the IMF may come in. The IMF has been pounding its fist on the table for a long time, saying you need to develop the infrastructure. But to a large extent, it's reliant on the political structure within a country to adopt the measures to develop that infrastructure. And sometimes it just doesn't work.
I think we'd better elaborate on what you mean by infrastructure. The message that gets out is free market, free market, free market. Of course, many of the countries, the world's most developed countries, have ridden free markets to tremendous heights of wealth, though not necessarily equal wealth among their citizens. So it's clear that it can work, but the reception in much of the world, and now in the developed world with the anti-globalization marches and sometimes riots out there, has been rough. Infrastructure almost seems like the opposite of what Americans often think of when they think of free markets. What do you mean, infrastructure?
That's a very good point. What we mean by infrastructure is the underlying rules, regulations, laws that keep the market level and make it accessible to all. So if you plot a graph with things like access to markets, efficient judicial system, the rule of law, all those things against the GDP of a country, you will see what is virtually a straight line. Countries that have better rule of law, better judicial efficiency, more transparent accounting, better corporate governance, all rank very highly, both in terms of the GDP and the level of these institutions. So the question you want to ask is, why do the other countries not have institutions? Is it that they don't know they need rule of law, they don't know that they need less corruption and so on, or is it somehow they haven't evolved to building the kinds of infrastructure that would make those things possible? And our argument is it's the latter. It's not that they don't know. They know fully well, but the elites in those countries find the status quo very pleasing and don't want to move in a direction which makes markets accessible to all.
And it's those elites, Jack Beattie, that Raghuram Rajan goes after in the title of his new book, Saving Capitalism from the Capitalists, saying they're trying to pull the ladder up, the rope ladder up behind them. They don't want to share the benefits of the free market. But of course, there's a huge global conversation going on globalization and free markets and what's worked and what hasn't worked. I've heard you deliver plenty of critique of this whole movement. Jack, what do you think as you read Raghuram Rajan and listen to him tonight?
Well, I'd like to hear his reaction to a sort of scorecard on globalization. In America in the 1950s, income, real wages grew 37%. In the 1960s, they grew 41%. Since 1973, when the era of globalization, you could say, began, liberalization of markets, financial markets, and so on, real wages have risen about between 7 and 8%, and more than 90% of that has gone to the top 20% and a shocking lot to the top 5%. Now, this has come during a time of globalization, deregulation, marketization, and so on. Now, it's not the only reason this has happened, but globalization was the dominating trend at the time. In the world at large, strong growth for the African countries in the 1960s, downhill ever since, precipitously downhill in the last decade. Latin America, growth 5.4% in the 1960s, 2.9% in the 1990s. As a whole, if you leave out China and perhaps India, you've got a downward trend of world income in the third world, and something like 100 million more people are living on $2 a day now than in 1990. So the question is, what went wrong? Why hasn't this worked for more people? Is it too much government control, too much crony capitalism, or is it too much market fundamentalism from the IMF?
Well, there's a full frontal attack. We'll come back and look at it after a break. We're talking tonight with the new chief economist of the International Monetary Fund, Raghuram Rajan, about free markets under fire and saving capitalism from the capitalists, the title of his new book. You can join the conversation. If free markets are the goal, should the American economy be the model for the world? And are yet freer markets the answer to global economic woe? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about free markets under fire with Raghuram Rajan, new chief economist of the IMF and co-author of Saving Capitalism. From the capitalists, you can join the conversation. What is the lesson of the 90s boom, bust, and scandals? Freer markets or more regulation at home and abroad? And is the globalization of free markets still the only way for world prosperity? Should free markets still be the IMF super prescription? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK with Raghuram Rajan. Native of India, long of University of Chicago, the youngest IMF chief economist to be named when he takes up that position in this October. And the first from the third world, Raghuram Rajan. You heard a kind of big frontal broad attack there from Jack Beatty, or at least a big question about how it's actually worked since the 70s when the free market philosophy, as you say yourself, really began to get traction. You welcome this and point to many benefits from it. Jack is saying, wait a minute, is it all benefits? How do you sum it up? On balance, Jack says something went wrong here and he wants to know what it is. Do you agree something went wrong? What's your analysis?
Well, he left out two important countries, as he said, India and China. That's one-third of the world. One-third of the world has become so much richer, partly as a result of free markets. I mean, think about India, which I know a little better than I know China. Mm-hmm. India had highly regulated markets. It had this license raj where only the rich business houses got the licenses to open businesses. All that got demolished in the 90s, partly as a result of IMF prescriptions. And what has happened is a growth rate of 6.5% to 7% every year since then, which has brought millions out of poverty. And all that has happened because now the rich the big business houses face competition from the outside. Let me give you a concrete example. The business houses used to have access to finance on their own because they control the large government institutions which doled out the finance. You knew somebody in Delhi, you got access to finance. You didn't know somebody in Delhi, you didn't get access to finance. Since then, what's happened is the stock markets have grown because these business houses know that they have to face competition from outside, from large industrial firms around the world who have access to cheap finance. So these business houses now work on the government to improve access to markets for themselves and in the process improve access to markets for the people at large. So now, for example, in India, you can borrow against your house. You can borrow to buy refrigerators. You can borrow to buy borrow scooters.
And you don't have to be a state-favored industry fat cat to do that.
Exactly. And why? So what we are arguing is open markets puts pressure on governments to work for the fat cats. But in the process of working for their own domestic fat cats and making them able to compete in the world market, they also improve access for their own people, which is a very good thing.
And yet you know the criticism, and you're hearing it again from Jack Beatty tonight, that free markets have been cruel, that they've been grinding people up, that their benefits have not been fairly distributed, and that millions, billions maybe, still live on next to nothing.
Yes, partly because their governments haven't, in fact, done the right thing, not so much because of free markets, but rather because they've resisted it. Take Latin America, for example. I won't name the country, but a World Bank mission went down to Latin America after one of the crises and said, we need to fix the financial system. We have to make it more transparent and more resilient to crises. One way to do it is to improve the rules which govern the sharing of information about collateral. If we have a central registry, for example, and I'm getting technical here, but I want to make the point, if we have a registry where people register their collateral, then the same, you won't have multiple lenders lending against the same collateral, which then becomes a problem when there's a crisis because we all come for their money when we find that it isn't there.
But this is an example of the kind of infrastructure that you're promoting.
Exactly.
Okay.
We need a collateral registry. And this is the advice they gave the large banks.
Yeah.
And they gave the government, they told the government, let's push it on the banks. And the banks responded by saying, we don't need it. We don't want it because we already know about our clients. We already have access to this kind of information. But if the registry comes in place, and this was the unsaid argument,
yeah,
if the registry is put in place, we'll have competition. We'll have people who are just springing up, who don't have all this access, who will be able to lend.
And anyone could read that central registry and get into business to compete with those banks. Jack Beatty, the fundamental message in response here is Raghuram Rajan saying the problem is not too much free markets in these decades, but too little truly free markets supported by the infrastructure that would make them fair and transparent.
Well, I mean, I think he's got an excellent point. I mean, apply it simply to agriculture. Look at what protection in agriculture has done. It is a form of economic warfare on the third world, and it extorts consumers in the developed world with the billions that we pay unnecessarily to farm interests. So that's a clear example where free trade would be a boon for mankind. But the other argument, of course, and it's one made by one of his predecessors at the world at the IMF, Joseph Stiglitz, is that something like what Professor Rajan sees as happening domestically, that is, governments becoming captured by special interests, has happened with these internationally, with these institutions, that the IMF serves financial interests, banks and stock markets and so on, and the WTO serves commercial interests. Their main criteria of success is not, you know, rising living standards or, you know, longevity or, you know, health or even equality or growing equality. It's simply the raw numbers. And with the IMF, the emphasis has all been on, or at least most of it has been on, containing inflation, on austerity and so on. And again, Stiglitz argues this has just been the wrong medicine.
Raghuram Rajan.
Again, without going into specific countries, part of the problem is that you have countries which are spending way above their budgets, right? Now, who's getting the benefit of the spending? In many countries, it is special privileged vested sectors which get a ton of money from the government and resist any change in that. And the IMF comes in and says, look, you can't live beyond your budget for a long time. Plus, it's not helping the people at large. It's helping these special sectors, these special interests. And so why don't we cut subsidies? So the IMF gives the prescription, let's cut subsidies, because you can't live beyond your means. It's just ruining your economy. What did the fat cats do? They cut subsidies for everybody else who actually needs it and keep the subsidies for themselves. And so as a result, what happens is this public anger, there's an uproar. Plus, at this point, the politicians say it's the IMF which made us do it, and these silly policies that we're following are not our own policies, but policies the IMF forced upon us. So what you have is belt tightening, but belt tightening being done in the wrong way. And I think the IMF realizes that it has to get more political ownership of the process and make people aware of what is going on and what has to be done to get the country on the right track.
So that's a big phrase, getting more political ownership of the process. You say in the book that one of the big problems here is the reliance on political goodwill for introducing this infrastructure. Are you talking about the IMF taking on greater powers than it has had to get into a country's politics?
No, I'm talking about the IMF doing more of a job in persuading the people of the country and right-minded politicians that the policies that it advocates, many of which are now focused on building up infrastructure rather than specific, rather than more detailed macro policies, but that the policies that it advocates are in the best interests of the country. So what the IMF now is trying to go, the road is trying to go further down is to try and persuade, this is the point about ownership, persuade the people and the politicians of the country to accept ownership of these policies and then leave those people to decide the details of the policy program. So there were many allegations, some of which came from Joseph Stiglitz, that the IMF interfered too much, was too detailed in its policy prescriptions during the Asian crisis. And we all remember the photo of Michel Kandesu standing with crossed arms, looking over Suharto's shoulder while Suharto signed the conditionality agreement.
Saying not
and
happy.
There was not a happy photo, which went around the world. It suggested the IMF had far more power than it actually has and that it was interfering far more. But the IMF is trying to back away from the image conveyed by that photograph and say that, look, we do think there are things that you should do, but it is very important for these things to be successful for you to take ownership of these plans.
Raghuram Rajan, new chief economist at the International Monetary Fund, please stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation Stephen Radlett. He's joining us from Washington, D.C. tonight. He's a senior fellow at the Center for Global Development, author of Challenging Foreign Aid, former deputy assistant secretary of the U.S. Treasury for Africa, the Middle East, and Asia from 2000 through 2002. Good evening and welcome, Stephen Radlett.
Thanks. My pleasure to be here.
Thanks for joining us. You have read some of Raghuram Rajan's book, and you've been listening in tonight. You hear his prescription for the future, and you know what the criticisms have been in the IMF over the last decade. Does this sound like the right new medicine to you?
Well, I think he's on the right track in that he's focusing on the institution's underlying markets to try to make them work better. Because I think that it has been one of the major problems in low-income countries around the world. The prescription in the 80s and early 90s had been just to free up the markets without paying attention to the key institutions that undergird markets that we all take for granted. You have to have a court system that makes contracts enforced. You have to have a legal system behind that. You have to have a good financial system. And we'd forgotten that, and that was one of the ingredients that led to the Asian financial crisis, is that there had not been enough attention paid to those institutions. So I think it will add a very important ingredient to making markets work better. The other thing, my other reaction is that we tend to speak in broad blanket statements about free markets working better or not working better.
Yes.
I think the real world is much more nuanced than that. We have had great success beyond China and India. We've had Korea, Taiwan, Hong Kong, Singapore, where per capita incomes grew by a factor of 7 in about 25 years, which is unprecedented in human history. We had Indonesia, Thailand, Malaysia, the Philippines, where incomes grew by a factor of 4. So there have been a number of countries with success. They have integrated into the world trading system, particularly for labor-intensive manufactured exports. And I think there's pretty strong evidence supporting that kind of policy change, which has led to real increases in incomes. But at the same time, these were not completely open economies by any stretch of the imagination.
So what do you take away from that? That the message of free markets is to be taken with a grain of salt?
I wouldn't put it that way. I would say that overall, I think the evidence is quite strong that free markets do work better for the majority of people. There are certainly distributional issues that underlie that. I don't think there's evidence that free markets necessarily lead to a worsening income distribution, but there certainly is some redistribution going on. In some countries it gets better, in some countries it gets worse. But I wouldn't say it's free markets with a grain of salt. Rather, that as we move towards free markets, we have to do it in a much more nuanced way, not an ideological way, and pick our battles in a more structured way, in a more orderly way, and think about getting the institutions right that underlie those. If we just try blanket prescriptions and try to enforce those over a 3, 4, 5 year period across many, many markets, it's not going to work very well.
Raghuram Rajan, I don't know that you're giving a blanket prescription, though you're certainly sticking to a core philosophy here. What do you think of Stephen Radlett's critique?
Well, unfortunately, I agree with everything he said, so you're not going to get a debate here. I mean, I think there is this issue that it's not that the imagery that one has to have of free markets is not the Wild West. It is of a level playing field. You have to create the level playing field. And sometimes, often it takes time. It takes a lot of time to create that playing field well. And you need the support of the people. You're not going to thrust it on somebody willy-nilly. And we have seen some of the prescriptions that were made immediately after the Asian crisis. Countries haven't followed them through, partly because now the crisis is gone and they're free to do their own thing. So in that sense, you need to get more ownership. You need to get the building process in place. It's going to take time. But I think in the end, the people are better off.
Raghuram Rajan, Stephen Radlett, Jack, please stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation from Sao Paulo, Brazil, Raymond Collett. He's Sao Paulo Bureau Chief for the Financial Times. Good evening and welcome, Raymond Collett.
Good evening, Tom.
Thanks for joining us. You've been listening in. You're hearing what the new chief economist for the IMF is going to be bringing with him to the International Monetary Fund to countries like Brazil. Does this sound as though it will be a welcome message in a country in Latin America where there's been a lot of trouble, Argentina struggling, Brazil teetering sometimes? Does it sound like Mr. Rajan is bringing the medicine that these countries want and need?
Well, I have been listening in, and I must say Brazil is in some ways a synthesis of everything that's been said so far. It's been a mixed bag of results for Brazil over the past decade. Globalization, opening of the markets have brought a lot of advance, modernization in several sectors of the economy, from telecommunications to banks to agriculture. Productivity has increased in many sectors. At the same time, you've had these repeated crises that obviously stall economic growth, lead to higher unemployment. So I think much of what has been said applies perfectly to Brazil. And there's now a reevaluation, obviously, of what went wrong. I don't think Brazilians are throwing the baby out with the bathwater, saying that all that we've applied over the past decade was wrong. No, there's fine-tuning. And I think the best example of that is, of this mixture of feelings, is precisely the election of President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva back in October, who came to power in January.
So if Mr. Rajan steps up and says, what you need is more infrastructure to support the Brazilian economy, more transparency, less corruption, more full access to markets, and we want to encourage a political embrace of this in Brazil, how's that going to go down?
Part of that is perhaps true, but I would say the stronger feeling today in Brazil is, look, we've done much of that. In many ways, Brazil has been a model pupil over the past 8 years, has cleaned house. They have reduced tariff. They have opened their economy. And what they find is now that they're productive and can export many of their products, particularly in agriculture, I can add steel, automobile industry, they're facing barriers. So they're saying, we did our part, now we want the other economies, leading economies in the world, to do their part.
Raghuram Rajan, can you respond to that?
Oh, I think this goes back to the point Alan Beatty made earlier. It is very important for the developed countries in the world to encourage this process in other countries by reducing those barriers, reducing the barriers to textiles, reducing the barriers to agriculture, in large part because the people who are exporting are the strongest constituency for open and freer markets in those countries, which eventually will absorb exports from the developed countries. So I think to encourage those constituencies, you do need to reduce barriers in developed countries, and that's immensely important for the growth of the world economy going forward.
Raymond Collett in Sao Paulo, Brazil, thank you so much for joining us just for a moment tonight. Much appreciated.
My pleasure.
And Stephen Radlett in Washington, D.C., thank you so much for being with us tonight.
My pleasure. Thanks.
Jack Beatty, well, there it is. It's a complex picture, whether you're sitting in Brazil or in Washington or in Raghuram Rajan's shoes about to take on a very big responsibility, a complex picture. He's trying to stick at the heart of it, though, to the notion that free markets will bring the best outcome.
And it's hard to argue with it in theory. It's just that practice is much more mottled. And I think Stephen Radlett was bringing out the East Asian examples where you had remarkable growth, but not wholly open economies, and indeed protected economies in many cases. So a mixed picture in terms of free market theory, a clear success in terms of real-world gain.
We're talking tonight about free markets and free markets under fire with Raghuram Rajan, new chief economist at the IMF. You can join the conversation. What's your question for the IMF's new top economist? And what do you think of the IMF track record over the last 10, the last 20 years? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about free markets and free markets under fire with Raghuram Rajan, new chief economist of the International Monetary Fund and co-author of the new book, Saving Capitalism, from the capitalists. You can join the conversation tonight. Is the world on the right path economically? Do we risk sliding into protectionism and economic contraction? And if free markets are the goal, should the American economy be the model for the world? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Patrick is calling from Minneapolis. Hi, Patrick. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I appreciate being able to listen to your show. You've got awesome guests.
Good to have you.
The question that I have, or the point that I wanted to make, was how much does cultural heritage, if that's the term, come into play in terms of how the free market works in other countries and how it has failed or succeeded in other countries? Whereas the U.S. has grown up on the free market concept, and other countries, they've been, you know, they're obviously significantly older. They've had cultures that go back for millennia that have attitudes and issues that conflict or, you know, work with each other. How does the free market, could that be a part of why the free market doesn't take hold in some of those countries? Is there, if it's trust or lack of trust?
Mm-hmm. Patrick, it's a great question, and we've got it, and thank you very much for launching it into the conversation. Raghuram Rajan.
Well, whenever I hear this question. It's a very good one. I'm reminded of a remark, and I'm going to misquote, but an American commander going to Japan in the late 1900s said the Japanese are a fat and happy people, and as such, unlikely to achieve much.
Right.
And we know the Japanese achieved a tremendous amount from then on. Mm-hmm. And that sort of tells me that it's an example, but I think cultural representations tend typically not to work very well because I think many nations are capable of growth, provided they have the right institutions. Korea, Taiwan, these are very different cultures from the United States. I do think that there might be some preconditions which help, some people have argued that the common law system around the world has been a force towards better markets. I also think the distribution of property does tend to work towards better markets. If property is more widely distributed and there's a strong upper middle class, these people tend to want the access that free markets bring and tend to resent the coziness that comes from elites, and they tend to push for better markets.
But ultimately,
so there might be some...
But I hear you saying there, Raghuram Rajan, that ultimately free markets are a universal prescription in your mind.
I think there's no reason that a people will be held back just because of their culture. If they have the right laws, if they have the right incentives, I think people are really fundamentally the same across the world. They might care a little more about their family. They might care a little less. But I think fundamentally they can all be persuaded.
But you point out different...
I was just going to say that the caller said we grew with free markets. Well, of course, we grew with protected markets. From 1866 to pretty much 1932, tariffs were never less than 28% here, highest in the world. Also, our growth was the highest in the world. So free markets were not how America grew.
Yes, there was a strong internal market. Of course, the point is absolutely right. America was strongly protected in the early years of growth. And again, the point Alan made earlier about South Korea, Taiwan, was right, that they did protect a lot more in their early years. But then you have other countries that protected and got nowhere. Latin America is an example. India is another example. Strong protection. But give an example. In the Indian automobile industry, we were still manufacturing the Ambassador car, which was a 1950 Morris
right.
In 1991, and it's a museum piece. And in 1991, they liberalized the automobile market, let foreigners come in. What happened? There was an Indian firm called the Tatas which decided to enter the market. It produced a car which was state-of-the-art but had immense quality problems. They found that they didn't have a market because now it was competitive and they couldn't sell the stuff. People actually wanted a good car. So they went back to the drawing board, worked very hard, came back with a revised model, and it swept the market. It's the biggest seller in the Indian market in its class. And I think India now has a strong automobile ancillary industry, a strong automobile industry of its own, partly because of the competition that was created by free markets. So the point, I admit the point that universal prescriptions are dangerous. But when you look at countries like Taiwan, when you look at countries like South Korea, there's a lot more going on than just the free markets. They focused immensely on improving the educational system, which paid a lot of dividends. So one has to be a little careful in saying that the only difference was free markets there.
Let's get another call. John's calling from Dorchester, Massachusetts. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Hi, Raghu. This is John Parsons calling.
Hey, John, how are you?
I'm very well. Congratulations on your book. I've been reading it this past week and having a good time. And it's a delightful coincidence to find out that you're on this show.
Great. John, what's your question?
I would characterize the book as describing everything as a contest in history between more or less finance, almost as if the place in finance in any economy could be measured on one dimension. And I'd like to hear Raghu talk a little bit about whether there might be different kinds of more finance, whether you could branch out in different directions, and whether there might be some directions of more finance that are to be pursued, and perhaps some directions of more and freer markets that might not be so good and we might want to avoid.
John, thanks for the question. Raghuram Rajan, it is very much focused, the book, on how easy or difficult it is for citizens in a particular economy to get access to capital, to start a business, to build a business, to grow a business, finance, as John, of course, describes it. How do you respond?
Well, first, let me mention that John has always asked a good question. John was my first advisor at MIT.
Oh, great. That's great.
The question, of course, we do focus on finance, and finance, I think, is just representative of markets in general. And it is possible that you can get excessive movement in financial markets and you can get an excessive quest for information. I mean, we don't need 300 analysts following the same firm. Probably 10 would do, and the other 290 are just making work for each other and moving the markets up and down for no reason.
There you're talking about the American model and partly discredited American model of the 90s.
The partly discredited. We'll come back to that, hopefully. But yes, there could be excessive investment in the financial sector, and there could be a lot of volatility, which is unnecessary. The problem is, like advertising, you don't know which part really works and which part is important, so you can't have a blanket prescription saying we'll have only 5 analysts and no competition amongst the analysts, because it's not clear that with those 5 analysts that you choose, you'll get an efficient market. So you, in some sense, need the competition, need the wastefulness in order to get the right outcomes. So yes, the answer is yes, there could be too much finance, and sometimes when we're talking about things other than access to finance and raising credit, there could be excessive movement in markets and too much effort being wasted there.
I'm sorry to break in, but we've only got a minute left, and I want to get your thought on one point. You say the movement toward free markets has been kind of cyclical. It's moved forward and back, and you raise the fear that it could move back again globally, that we could head into an era of constricted economies and less globalized economies, less free economies. How real is that threat in your mind, very briefly?
Well, it depends a lot on the attitude in the United States. The United States is the biggest economy in the world. If the United States becomes more protectionist over time, and you see some signs, though not really strong ones. The steel tariffs were an example, but another example is many states are now talking about outsourcing to other countries and saying we won't support companies which do that kind of outsourcing. If the recession persists, and we've heard Chairman Greenspan today saying that perhaps it may not, but if it does, these kinds of protectionist forces may become stronger, and protectionism in America will become a disease which spreads through the world. So we have to make really sure this doesn't happen.
Raghuram Rajan, youngest ever chief economist for the IMF. Congratulations on your appointment. We hope we can have you back to talk once you get in the saddle there. Good luck.
Thank you very much.
Raghuram Rajan is professor of finance at the University of Chicago Graduate School of Business. He's co-author of Saving Capitalism from the Capitalists. You can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, the new White House press secretary faces tough questions on the deficit. This is On Point. The federal budget deficit has leapt to a record projected $455 billion this year, the White House Office of Management and Budget announced today. That is 50% higher than the Bush administration forecast 5 months ago and marks a $680 billion turnaround since the surplus of the year 2000. New White House Press Secretary Scott McClellan faced tough questions from reporters about the deficit on his first day on the job.
I'd like to ask you a question that you can draw on your vast previous experience before joining the White House. You successfully ran 4 political campaigns. Would you want to be entering an election year running on a $455 billion deficit?
John, I'm glad you brought that question up. Because it gives us an opportunity to lay out and remind the American people the situation that we are in. We have a deficit that is a concern, but it is a manageable one, and we are working to address it. The president's highest priorities will always be winning the war on terrorism, protecting the American people, and getting our economy growing stronger and faster. And that's where his focus is. Now, we had a recession. We also had declining revenues because of that. And we had a war on terrorism. That's what led to the deficit that we are in today. And the way we get out of that deficit is to continue to get our economy growing and create jobs. And that's why the president has acted on a jobs and growth plan, not only this year, but in previous years as well. And we also need to hold the line on spending, and that's what we're working to do with Congress. The president's budget holds growth and discretionary spending to below 4% because he believes government spending should not grow faster than family income. So this is an important issue that we are working to address. And over the next few years, what you're going to see is that we're going to cut that deficit in half based on the projections that are being outlined later today. But as a percent of GDP, the deficit is currently at 4.2%. That's well below the 1983 peak modern-day deficit of 6%. It's also the same or smaller than deficits following similar recessions. So these deficits right now are not hurting or harming our economy as interest rates remain at 45-year lows.
So you have a $455 billion deficit this year, $475 next year. It seems clearly that's a political liability heading into an election.
And then you look at the economic forecast as well, that our economy is expected to be growing a lot stronger in the coming years, beginning next year.
Is it not clearly a political liability going into an election?
No, I think the American people recognize that the president has taken decisive steps to create an environment for job creation and economic growth. The president is focused on creating jobs. We had a recession, and people are looking for work. And as long as there's one person looking for work, the president is going to remain concerned and going to remain focused on what's most important, which is getting our economy growing. Now, at the same time, addressing the deficit is a priority, and we are doing that. And we have been very clear with the American people about why we are in the situation we are in. But again, I mean, the fundamentals, lower taxes, a positive outcome in Iraq, strong housing markets, record low interest rates, renewed consumer confidence, and low inflation have put things in place for a strong recovery in job growth.
The new White House press secretary, Scott McClellan, discussing the new federal budget deficit figures released today, his first day on the job. Jack Beatty, Scott McClellan rides into the White House on a rough number and gets some rough questions.
He does. And did you notice he didn't mention tax cuts, about $2 trillion worth? They have nothing to do with the deficit, of course. You know, today he was greeted by a column from the dean, David Broder, in today's Washington Post, who posited that last Thursday, July 10th, I think it was, may have been Black Thursday for President Bush. He said it was the day that the worst unemployment figures in 20 years appeared and the day when the president admitted that, yes, in fact, he had used false, erroneous, whatever you want to call it, information in his State of the Union address.
But the triplet is still there. The new press secretary says he will be focused on national security, the war on terrorism, and the economy, making no apologies.
Making no apologies and spinning and making the best out of what he can. It's very hard to, you know, just in the abstract, defend a figure like that. And, of course, in the one hand, he said it's bad. On the other hand, he said, but relative to the size of the economy, it's not so bad. It's called arguing in the alternative.
And so off we go. Jack, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Eileen Amata, Chris O'Connor, Virginia Prescott, John Roberts, James Ross, Karen Schiffman, and Tim Skog, with help from Julie Jupp. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.